the participants. So if we have decided to take lunch at 11, that gives everybody who wants to go the opportunity to go there. We were hoping for some buffet lunch, but that didn't materialize, so we could have basically taken that on the way back in and load up on the plates and carry on while we're eating here. But maybe whoever does that thing, we can crash the preparations for the CCTLD buffet or something. Yeah, otherwise we'll have to just get on. Good. And then we meet at 12:30 and for the afternoon session. The afternoon session has got some major coolness factor, I understand. In particular, Matt Larson is going to repeat the Dwayne Wessel's performance from Center about the graphical analysis of DNS server affinity, which I understand is very cool. He was traveling, so we put him and Dave Piscitello, who is also traveling until this morning at the end, so that they have got some time to rest in case that interfered with the previous agenda. Is there any questions that we need to bring up? Not yet. The coffee, unfortunately, is on the ground floor. Yeah, so if you want to get a coffee, you have to run downstairs in between, grab a coffee and come back. It's not that we have got an urn in front of us here. All right. Let's start then. I welcome Andrei Bartoszewicz, who used to run .pl and who now is going to talk about best practices for secure CCTLD environments. I forgot noch one more thing. This meeting is on the Adobe Connect remote presentation. So all our outside participants can basically read the more or less the same presentations as we're having here. They were uploaded onto the system, and they may lack a little bit of graphical transitions and things, but otherwise it should work.
Okay, thank you, Eberhard. Thank you for coming. I hope it will be interesting presentation, not only for techies. I decided to, actually it's divided in three parts. It's the technical part, the part related to people and the business and management. And actually this technical part is more or less for managers and business people, just to see what kind of problems we are facing and what we need to address those problems. And it's also for techies to see the problems we are facing with people using the systems and where can be the vulnerabilities. As Eberhard said, I used to work for PL Registry. Me and my colleagues, we left Registry recently and started a company which is actually focused on software security. When we talk about CCTLD environment, we can define it whatever way we want, but we can talk about technology and infrastructure. We can talk about business and legal part. And of course, we talk about people that run this this TLD, this activity. But of course, it's also a broader scope. We have registry, and we can have everything working perfectly at the registry. And I will give you the examples at the end of the presentation when registry did everything perfectly. but you have subscribers that can do something wrong, really wrong. Registrars that they are not focusing on security as well. We have different vendors, we have law enforcement agencies, we have governments. Of course, the governments don't make mistakes, so this is. And we have trademark owners. And of course, we can present other entities which are in our environment. What kind of threats we are facing? In case of technology, we are facing bugs, we are facing vulnerabilities. There is also malice, and it's related to technical side and people as well. We talk about the backdoors. Of course, financial decisions are affecting registries very much. Naivety, and people sometimes, even managers, are doing very stupid things, which, I mean, techies can do perfect systems, 100% secure, but then there can be some vulnerabilities coming from business and people. It's about legal decisions. When we talk about people, there is also very often lack of knowledge, which affects our activities, theft, and so on. Okay, let's move to the technical part. And these two charts are, one is cert.org and one is sans.org. Data come from them. And they are quite similar, and it shows what percentage of, and sorry for these small letters, it shows what are the source of the technical threats, and the application is dominant. So attacks and vulnerabilities in applications are dominant if we are talking about threats. And then it goes application web servers, operating systems, network hardware, etc. So the most dangerous part is actually our applications. When we talk about application weaknesses, there are many sources of this. It's very often lack of knowledge. And very often, developers are not aware about security and other issues. And you probably know about the problem we are facing very often. It's high rotation of developers, which theoretically shouldn't have had impact on the development process, but very often it has. Many freshman developers and changing technologies. When there are very often business decisions about changing the technologies to better technologies, it very often causes some problems. And of course, complexity of software development and changing requirements, size of code base, and growing technology stack. So we have new and new technologies, and we put one on the top of another. When we talk about application weaknesses, so we talk about bugs, and this is about correctness, and it's about internal incorrect execution of the programs. And of course, it's about security vulnerabilities. There can be bugs which can cause, I mean, some damage by themselves just because application is run, and it's about external attacks. When we talk about bad practices, it's very often about performance bottlenecks, and this is very, I would say, very interesting, and very often it is ignored, this problem. There can be some small performance bottlenecks which you can calculate in milliseconds, and which can be then used by attackers. When we talk about bad practices, it's also about low maintainability, which in the long term it leads to more bugs. And of course, backdoors and the illegal access. It's the story. I hope it will never happen. It will never happen in our environment, but I wouldn't be so sure about it if we talk about the registrars. Okay, she got a phone call. Hi, this is your registry. We are having some troubles. What happened? did you really name your company Yon Consulting? Drop table domains. And of course, it was executed. The table has been dropped. So this was just a funny story, but this is not the funny story. Actually, this is about vulnerability, XSS vulnerability. This is very well known vulnerability and very well known for years or decades. It's about injecting, for example, JavaScript through the web page, and then it is executed by the by someone else, and this JavaScript does something which is it's intended to do by the attackers. And when I've talked with my colleagues about what kind of examples can we give during these presentations, because I decided not to give the examples which are actually can be some bad guys can use actually against TLDs and exploit those vulnerabilities. So let's try to find if XSS is still a problem in our industry. I said, no way. I mean, it's 2010, and you have never, I have never expected that this can be a problem today. And actually, we've checked five TLDs. I'm not going to give the names. I've contacted one of them, and I'm going to, if I see them around, I will contact another one. And I was astonished, surprised, whatever. Among those five TLDs, and I'm not talking about small TLDs, one TLD allowed JavaScript to be injected into database, into Whois. And there was no B2B sanitization at all. There was a pure JavaScript injected that can be executed. And the next example is even more confusing, because the registry was well protected. I mean, some fields in the database were well protected. So if you when you try to inject JavaScript, they said no, it's you can do this, and there are syntax errors. But some fields were not. So for example, company name was protected, but the address was not protected. So it means that this registry and the developers or vendors of this registry knew very well about this threat, but they forgot to protect all entries to the registry. So, I mean, it is something really surprising, I would say. I also check registrars, and I was even maybe not very surprised because they are focused only on money and don't care about technology very much. I started checking registrars, and after checking three registrars, I was surprised because all of them were vulnerable to XSS. Then I checked two another, and okay, it means not everyone screw things. And this is actually the example, and I'm not going to give you the output from who is directly from the registry, those affected registries, because then you can identify them, and this is not my idea. This is the example of the Hello World to be the pop-up window to be put on the screen when the Whois is checked, and this comes actually from one registrar. And instead of address, it's just the window. And of course, if you just put the JavaScript as it is, it will not work. But if you do a little bit, if you try to trick the registrars and registries, it took 2 minutes for me to do this. You can trick them. So it's very sad. When we talk about examples about vulnerabilities, and you probably know, you are aware of this, we are talking about concurrency and DB issues, database issues. Very often when I talk to developers, they are not aware, I mean, they are not aware about multi-threading. They say, okay, some procedures are executed in milliseconds, and we have millions of domain names. It's unlikely that two different parties, I mean, two different processes can start doing something on the same domain name, but I mean, statistically, it's possible, and very often it happens. The very basic example is that if one thread is locking a domain name and then locking account related to the domain name, and a different thread is locking first account for this domain name and then locks the domain name itself. And if both of them starts almost the same time and the first locks domain name, the second locks account, you have deadlock and nothing happens. And this is, of course, vulnerability. And we are talking about other issues like correctness, deadlocks, which I gave the example, the performance, and denial of service. This is interesting, how the bottleneck can cause denial of service attack. And this is the example how drop catchers can actually use this performance bottleneck. I know that some registries are aware of them, of this problem, because I've talked with them also. When the function runs along or locks a domain, and there is, for example, DNS check inside a database transaction or some heavy processing inside a database transaction, like additional or removal of many objects, then it's not well managed, then it's a bottleneck, and this function, instead of doing the job in 40 milliseconds, do it in 80 milliseconds or 2 seconds. It's not a problem because it can affect just few domain names, but when we are talking about domains that they are becoming available for registrations, for example, drop catchers can use it, can use this bottleneck vulnerability, which is theoretically not a bug, but in some cases it can be used for some bad guys to use it to gain profit from such activity. And here is the example about the backdoor, which it was very surprising to me to see this. My company have been asked some time ago to do the analysis about the part of their software. The company suspected a backdoor. And actually, this comes from the bank industry. It was one of the three largest banks in Poland, and the software is run in other banks as well. And I mean, the first signal came from intrusion detection system, and they were not aware what is going on. It was done in Oracle forms and PLSQL. We did the reverse engineering, and we found that there is a backdoor, and when some parameters are set, everyone, and especially the guy from the software vendor, can execute whatever action on the database. I mean, regardless of the fact that they haven't had the administrative privileges or privileges to the database, but using the Oracle forms, they were actually, in some circumstances, they were able to execute whatever PLSQL function. And what is even more funny, the bank was very smart, and they haven't informed the vendor about this. They just asked the vendor, "Hi guys, what's with this software? Because we don't know how it works." And the software vendor said, "Yes, it was the old function, and we will remove it." And they remove it, but just on paper. They transferred the same function to another part of the software and did some added some spaces, changed a little bit this function. So if you just compare binaries, it was different. And we did the same analysis again. And I mean, probably it will end up in the court. But in this case, I have to say the vendor was very stupid, because if you are detected, you should remove it anyway. But it shows how vendors can behave. Okay, let's go further. When we talk about traditional best practices for software development, we are, and you can be surprised with talk about it as traditional. We talk about education and its advanced training, which is rather coaching, and very often people think that, okay, let's someone is has graduated studies, let's let him learn some new technology, some new language, and I mean it's also about the programming art. We are talking about development process. We are talking about test-driven development. I talk about it as traditional, but it came. The idea is from 1999, and it was in quite popular in 2003. But we can actually say it's traditional. We talk about unit tests, integration tests, performance tests. You know about it. All these techniques, continuous integration. We talk also about independent verification. It's about audits and the black box testing and code audits. The question is it enough? The problem is that the problems which are facing very often is that the software becomes more and more complex and the size grows. And the program testing can be used to show the presence of bugs, but never to show the absence. So you always learn that there are bugs, but you never learn that there is no more bugs. And of course, we can use computers to do this job. And it's about automated tools, and we talk about generating automated tools which generate test data and test suites and application scans. And something which is now, let's say, on the top of the software testing are the static analysis and the dynamic analysis. Dynamic, which means that we instrument the code and we analyze execution of programs. And what those tools can find, and this is very often the code level issues like infinite loops, memory leaks, etc. It's security vulnerabilities like injection, like this cross-script scripting, which was mentioned before, and cross-site request forger, which is more advanced cross-accesses. It's about buffer overflow, etc. It's also about deadlocks, which are very difficult to identify in the typical tests. And there are innovative approaches, which is about identifying semantic bugs, architecture and design issues, transactional database issues, which I mentioned with this multi-threading. And here you have some examples about automated tools. There are tools which are for free, and there are commercial tools. The biggest problems, which probably you know about, is about that the tools are very often focus on some kind of problems. There is no good, so far there is no good tools which cover all the issues, all the potential vulnerabilities, and as well another problem is that they are very often working on the small part of the software. So you very often, I mean, it happens that the problem cause is hundreds of lines before the real problems is visible. So this is also what we are doing at my company, and we are going to release this software. But this is not marketing presentation, so I'm not going to talk about it deeply. And when we talk about automated tools, these previous slides, which are put in one slide, we talk about integrated development environment. We talk about patterns and anti-patterns. We talk about dynamic analyzer, static analyzer, provers. We have these test generators, test executors, and of course, something which is going to be popular. It's automated fixes, but they are just for small. They are, as well as other tools, they are just fixing some well-defined issues, and they are not flexible. Okay, so we don't have much time, so let's go further with the presentation. And this part of the presentation is rather for managers, it's for techies. It's about people. And you can have great software, great not in the matter of size, but of its quality. But you have people that they are using the software in the company, outside the company, and very often the threats come from people, and they come from employees. It's about lack of knowledge and experience of the employees. This is about disgruntled current or ex employees. It's about social engineering, and it's also about management without external tight control. It's about stolen, lost documents, laptops, but this is something old, and everyone care about software security and stolen data. But there is also in between the issues like social engineering, which becomes more and more problem for TLDs as well. When we talk about lack of knowledge, we talk about employees without proper training or education. We talk about administrative decisions which are based on not verified documents, and the recent example about Baidu.com is I think it's the best example when without proper documentation some actions has been taken. And very often it's about too complicated or not updated frequently procedures inside the company, and it results that employees just disregarding procedures. They just don't care. If the procedures are too complicated or they are out of date, they just skip them. And of course, about remedies, continuous trainings, well-defined and proved procedures, like we talk about proved code, which is the holy grail of software developers. We talk about proved procedures and workflows. It's about up-to-date knowledge base and the access for the employees. Very often we have well-done knowledge bases, but the data in the knowledge base are so crucial for the company and so confidential, so employees don't have the access to this knowledge base. So, I mean, why to have the knowledge base? Here I will give you some examples about social engineering, and generally social engineering and phishing is the way of using the social engineering techniques. It's of course the, as Wikipedia says, act of manipulating people to do something that they are not they should not do, but they were asked to do, and there are different attacks. Different ways to conduct attack. It's phone. It's called phishing. It's email. It's web. It's fax, or sometimes, but not likely, it's in person. And I have actually learned quite recently there is a special name for the phishing attack which targets top management. It's whaling. And. So the attack can target employees on all levels, and it's about the technical staff, but very often the administrative staff, but also, the secretary can be subject to phishing attack, and it can bring really, it can be really profitable sometimes, and more profitable than just getting some users' data. And of course, the CCTLD can be subject to the attack in, I said, four different ways, but it can be even more ways. Of course, the employees of the registry can be target of an attack. Registrars can be a target for an attack, and it has influence on the registry, of course. domain holders can be targeted by phishers, and of course domain names can be used as a tool, part of the tools for phishing. So I mean, TLDs are in a special situation that they can be attacked and they can be used to attack others. And this is about this configure issue actually, as well as an example of registry to be used as the let's say attacking tool. And of course registry must address all four aspects of phishing. And I'm not going to go into details, we don't have time, but it's about educating people, it's about dedicated trainings, courses, procedures, and actually it's also about user credentials, not allowing certain actions if not part of day-to-day duties. I was surprised when I talked with my friend from one registrar. I tried to do something on my domain names, and I was not able to do this. And then I asked him, because he is also my friend, he's the CEO of this company, and I asked him, I mean, why you don't allow me to do this activity, to change some data? And he said, we know about this problem, but we have such cases 3 times a year. So instead of letting people do something which can cause some other side effect, it's better if it's escalated. It's escalated to the managers 3 times a year. And this is, I think, a good example of if something happens not, I mean, quite rarely, and your, for example, your employees have to do with some special cases, and they do it once per month, once per week, maybe they don't need the credentials to execute this action. Maybe it's better to have this escalation process. We always want to make everything as low as possible, so the employee can do everything and to go through the business procedure as fast as possible. But in some cases, maybe not everyone should have the administrator passwords. Okay, oops. And this is the example I've mentioned previously. It's the Baidu.com. I mean, it was in the press, so we can talk about it. And it's, I mean, it's amazing when you read it. When I've learned about it, I was really amazed that register.com, very well known and registrar, and you would expect really high quality of their high quality from them, was just cheated by someone who changed the credentials and then changed the name server. So the guy was just hijacked the domain name, changed the credentials, actually changed the address, changed the credentials, and then changed the name servers. It should never happen. But what was the cause? Probably, I mean, Baidu is a well-known trademark and well-known company, so probably register.com wanted to make this company happy and do whatever they want just to have a happy customer, especially the key customer. And, I mean, it resulted in a disaster. There was also the case with Hotmail in Israel. And if you look at they are Microsoft's domains. But when you look at who is the registrar and who is the technical contact, you'll be surprised. I mean, also top well-known companies. It's a disaster. And of course, we talk about disgruntled current and ex-employees, which can be potentially the most dangerous. It's very often it's malice or theft, and both and both reasons apply. Some people would like just to steal something, and some just are sorry, and some are just not happy, I would say, with the employer. So the employees may steal, copy the data, and they can also delete, encrypt, or even the worst case scenario is alter the data in the company database and the company do not see it. And of course, the remedies are quite similar and as before. So monitor all activities if possible, and start with smallest possible privileges. Very often, and it's apply very often to the technical staff. We hire someone, and if we don't give him or she the credentials which allow all the activities this person will do in the future, he might be not happy, okay, because we don't trust him or we just don't trust her, etc. And of course, never give administrative privileges or semi-administrative if not necessary. This is about the case about employee from former technology expert from HSBC who steal data for 24,000 accounts. And I mean, probable case is that he didn't need this access, and but he got full access to the database and just downloaded this data. This is about contractor who was doing the administrative stuff. They was updating software, and probably he needed the administrative privileges as well. And this is about the previous case is about the employee. In this case, is about the contractor. And this is the most devastating, actually, case I have ever heard. Devastating because the company, I don't know how it is managed, but they fired IT director, and I have to say, yes, they should do it, because what you could see after. They fired IT director and haven't changed the credentials. And I have to say, she was so stupid to log on using her credentials from her home, using VPN, to the company systems, and then she used credentials of other employee to delete the data. So the first, I mean, if you fire someone or someone leaves, of course, all the credentials must be terminated. Then, I mean, if she was an IT director, I can understand how it happened, because then she was logging from, if I want to steal something, I would never log on from my home. She log on from home, and it's even more devastating. She knew the credentials. She had the credentials of other employees. So probably because she was IT director, she has users and passwords or some other credentials of employees in her department. So she, impersonating them, she could do something. So I mean, it's amazing. And when we talk about the last part of my presentation, which will take 1 minute, and Everhart will be happy, it's about business versus technology. And very often, the problem occurs on the way from business, from management, to the technical people. And this is the example, and this is the last slide, about how bad can be communication between business and technical people. It's about land rush of IDNs under .tel. And actually, I give this example because I was registering a domain name, and actually, Telnik did everything well. There is no... Telnik is did it perfectly. They had well communication. The land rush went smoothly. It was okay from the registry point of view. And I've tried personally to register one domain name, which is andriy.tel, it's in Cyrillic. I decided to have my first domain in Cyrillic. And I tried to register a domain name, and I went to one registrar, the first one. And I've got the response that the characters are not allowed. The string I entered is not allowed. I tried Unicode, I tried IDNA, the same result. I contacted CEO of this company, as well as my friend, and asked him, "Hi guys, what are you doing? The land rush is already in place, and Cyrillic and other IDNs are allowed." And he said, "Yes, we know, but the business decision was that we are not going to implement it in the next 2 weeks." I said, "Haven't you communicated with your techies just to put some information?" Or, "Yes, you are right, we forgot." Then I came approach another registrar. And so, I mean, I got the information, the domain is invalid. I tried to do this throughout another registrar, also well known, and I got the information, domain is taken. So probably they haven't, I mean, they were supporting IDNs, but they haven't changed the parameters after a land rush. This is my guess. And I approached the third one, and of course the time was leaking, so I was afraid that my domain can be taken and I will never register it again. And I approached another registrar and I got information, "Yes, your request is pending. My credit card was charged." And the explanation was that, yes, because some registries have some requirements, then we need some time communicating with them. And I was waiting 1 hour, 2 hours. I was surprised because domain name was still available. I've contacted their support. The next day they answered, "Actually, yes, we do support IDNs, and this is on our webpage, except Cyrillic." I mean, this is also the case where there was no, I mean, this is very easy, easy procedure just to put correct information on site or make system behaving in the correct way. But they actually, there was a failure on the communication between business and the technology. So I used the fourth registrar who registered in milliseconds actually, and it was done. But I mean, it explains three different possibilities how there was a very bad communication between management of the company, in this case registrars, and technical people. Okay, thank you very much. And as you see, I'm using .tel domain as well, and I like those guys, so that's why I was giving this example. And once again, they did everything well, but the registrars actually failed in this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Only 2 minutes longer than intended. To placate one particular irate member of the audience who berated me by email, whose name will not be mentioned. Dasek. Okay, the next presenter is Norm Ritchie. He will brief us about recent development in ISC. I forgot to mention that two members of the technical working group and our official observer, also known as the lurker, Warren Kumari, have been elected or appointed as trusted community representative for the root signing process. You can use the microphone, then people can hear you.
Are we allowed three in the room at the same time, or is that a security issue?
Well, I think we've got four in the room at the same time. because I find this is a significant issue. We pushed Norm from the technical working group a little bit, so that worked out. And Warren Kumari is, as the observer, he is a backup recovery key shareholder. Norm is a recovery key shareholder. And then we have got Dmitry Burkov. I don't see him here at the moment. He is a crypto officer for the West Coast facility. I think this is significant that the technical working group has got a few members on this team. It also improves the trust. And the idea was to create some element of trust in the process. And the idea being that if you know the people and you trust the people, then the process, if they can vouch for the process, then you can trust the process implicitly. In any way, Norm now works as the director for new projects with ISC, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, red button, big red button.
Called manager.
And he can go ahead without further ado.
There you go. That's for you. This work? Yeah. My slides just bit the dust on my brand new laptop, and I won't say who's the manufacturer of the laptop, but not very happy. So it's very fortunate though that Shane Kerr is here as well. Shane's the program manager for Bind 10, and he's an extraordinary individual and doing a wonderful job. So he'll actually give an update on Bind 10. I was going to show you some information and some examples from Bind 9.7, so that's not going to work. So what I will do, I'll just try to quick.
Did you upload your presentation before it?
No.
Because if you had the exhaust, then we could just put it on the Adobe and you could present from there.
Okay. Yeah. So anyway, I just wanted to... just want to give you an update on ISC. So for those that really don't know ISC, it's a not-for-profit organization. We produce open-source software, primarily for the names and numbering side of the Internet. We're best known for Bind. We also provide, provide those public benefit services, we also have professional services and consulting that we provide. And the money from that actually allows us to do the public benefit work. So one of the things I found, I started with ISC back in February. So like many of you, I knew ISC, and I knew it for Bind. But there was a lot more to it, and I was very surprised, all the number of things that go on at ISC. So what I want to do is just quickly go through those. Unfortunately, like I say, I don't have that information with me. So two things. One is to have a look at Bind 9.7 if you're deploying DNSSEC, because it's much more simplified as far as the syntax of that goes. And the other thing then, if Shane is ready, perhaps we can give an update on Bind 10. As you can see, I'm kind of stalling for a bit of time here. And I apologize for not having my slides.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I didn't know we were...
I apologize for not sending them to the internet.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I didn't know I was supposed to send these slides, so I'll just be reading them here. But there's not that much on them, so you can just listen to my lovely voice as I talk along here. So this will be very boring for some of you who've seen me talk about Bind 10 probably a half dozen times. But for the rest of you, I hope you find it a bit useful. So I assume everyone in the room knows what Bind is, hopefully. Bind is DNS server software. It acts as both authoritative and as a recursive server. Bind is currently used by about 80% of DNS servers in the world. This number was pulled from a study that was conducted outside of ISC, but it's been replicated over a few years, and it seems to be fairly stable. And to be clear, this doesn't mean that 80% of domains are served from a bind server. It doesn't mean that 80% of queries come from or answered by bind servers, but it does mean that 80% of servers are run ISC bind. And I think the important thing to take from this is that if you think that DNS is important, if it's important to you and your business, then bind is important to you and your business, and the success of this software is actually important to you. So that's bind in general, and mostly that's about bind 9. Bind 9 is the current version of bind that we've been using for about 10 years. So I'm here to talk about bind 10, which is, of course, the next version of bind that we're working on. Bind 9 is, as I said, about 10 years old now. And since bind 9 was originally designed, the computing world has changed. My phone here has more horsepower than a server did 10 years ago. It has more memory and runs cooler applications, and I can make phone calls and things. So it's the computing world is very different. On the server side, we see multi-core taking over. We see concerns about power consumption, which just frankly didn't exist 10 years ago, and cooling and things like that. And so any software that's designed today has to exist in a totally different environment than software from 10 years ago. Oh, I've been given a connector here. Let's see what happens. All right. Cool. Don't need that. Okay, cool. Technology, nice. Right, so as I said, bind 9 is 10 years old, the computing world has changed. Also, the networking world has changed. We see everyone has broadband now under their homes. We see people getting what was considered broadband quality connections on their phones now. People are much more mobile with their communications. We see a lot of consolidation in terms of transit and things like that. So the networking world is very different. The expectations of users is also very different. 10 years ago, you would expect a couple hundred milliseconds delay, and that was quite okay. Today, that's unacceptable for people, and we need to figure out how to provide services in those kind of environments. And this other bullet I have here is that the DNS software marketplace has evolved. What I mean here is that there's a lot more niches, a lot more little special use cases that people have for DNS now. 10 years ago, DNS was basically something that your server weenies would run. They set up a server somewhere running DNS, and that was pretty much your whole dedication to DNS. Today, the client side is more interesting. The separation between registries and registrars has created new models. People now do DNS hosting in a scale that didn't exist 10 years ago. And people have provided software to meet these different needs, and we hope that Bind 10 will be there to answer all needs, actually. And that's pretty much it for Bind 10. We need software to handle all of these changes and to be there as the DNS software for the next 10 years. Right, so very quickly about the Bind 10 project. The Internet Systems Consortium, ISC, was the initiator of the project. We tried to find funders. We're a nonprofit open source company, so we can't just do what we want to do. We need to have money from somewhere. So this is a pretty large scale development project, so we sought some funders. We had a very generous set of initial sponsors. You can see the URL there, including our patron sponsors, Sierra, JPRS, and CNNIC. Now, these sponsors came together and formed a steering committee. It's a bit like a board of directors for an organization. They kind of oversee the project. They're not involved with the day-to-day affairs, but they're there to make sure that things pretty much stay on the right track and that we don't take Bind 10 off and build some sort of 3D rendering engine or something weird like that. So to make sure that we do what we're supposed to do. The project was officially started on April Fool's Day, 2009. That is really the date. It's not a joke. Yeah. So here's a rough timeline of how the project is going. It's broken down in a five-year plan, year by year. There's a nice little checkbox by the year one there. We finished that at the end of March in 2010. So we now have an authoritative only server that you can download. That was our first major milestone. Our milestone for the current year is to do a recursive server. We're about a quarter of the way through that right now. And then our goal for the next year is to have a production quality server, one that anyone can run in any general environment. Our goal for year four is to have a version of the server that you can just drop on a server that has bind 9 and have it take over without a very, very, very minimum of administrative changes and just have it do its thing. And year five is what we save for doing all the very interesting stuff like more interesting cluster support, working better in embedded environments, more custom plugins and things like that. So the development, it's a different model for ISC than what we've done in the past. Our development is very, very open right now. You can see that first URL there. That's our track site. It's a development website. It's a wiki. Anyone can create an account and update that site. We put as much of our documentation and as many of our plans as we can on that site. We have a mailing list where the developers do their thing. It's pretty high volume right now. We get, I'd say, probably 3 or 4 posts a day about the software development. It's archived. You can see all that. It's all in public. Anyone can join. If you want to subscribe to the list, you can do it right now. And our code is also public, so you can see all of the horrible bugs we've introduced and then later fixed. It's all available for you. So right now we've got the Bind 10 team working on this. We've got 6 staff at ISC working on this, not all full-time, but some of them. We've got 2 part-time people from JPRS, the Japanese registry, and 4 part-time people from CNNIC, which is the Chinese registry, working on this as developers. So that's kind of the motivation and how the project is formed and things like that. So what is Bind 10 actually going to bring? How is it different? On the architecture side, it's modular. This means that we break it up into components that can be plugged together and run independently. Our vision here is that people should be able to take the software and customize it as very easily. Well, that's a bit later. That's a feature. Another part of our design is that we want to have well-defined APIs and libraries. With earlier versions of Binds, there are libraries that you can use, but they're not intended as output of the project. So they're there kind of as a side effect of having to make a working server. In this case, we make libraries. We make pieces of code that we hope people can take and reuse in ways that we don't expect. That's our fantasy. And, of course, full runtime control. There's a lot of things with current DNS software that require you to stop servers and restart them or change configurations in quite cumbersome ways. With Bind 10, everything will be changeable at runtime. You won't ever have to restart the system. And ultimately, if you're running Bind 10 in a cluster, you should be able to add and remove machines from the cluster, have them automatically detect that they're running in that environment, and configure without any additional work from your administrators. So that's the goal. What does this mean as to our features? Everything's customizable. We recognize that especially enterprise users have, every enterprise, every big company has a very unique environment. We want to make it easy for people to slot Bind 10 into that environment. Right now, people dump a lot of configuration and then start Bind 10 using Perl scripts and shell scripts and kind of a bit of developer duct tape to keep things running. We want to make that, we want to get rid of that painful hacked environment and make it easier for people to customize a server, even without code. Resilience to failures. The system right now runs as a collection of independent processes. This means that a failure in any one part should not affect the operation of the system. That's very important for us. A lot of our security problems that we've had with Bind 9 over the years have actually been us being overprotective to make sure the system doesn't get corrupted in some ways and then shutting down if that happens. Which is, from a security point of view, very good, but from an administrator point of view, it's a nightmare because your server stops and restarts occasionally, which is very bad for user experience and bad for system load and things like that. And then finally, cluster support. I've talked about that a little bit. I won't go into too much more detail. Here's our 2 minutes. Okay, we should be all right. This is our process model, lots of little lines and things connected and all that good stuff, what you normally see in software diagrams and things. I think from my point of view, the most important and interesting thing of this model is that we've got these little disk-like things called data sources there. This is what Bind10 has, what we call a abstract data source, which means that you can put different types of data at the back end. You can put SQL. You can use something like the current in-memory database. We're going to be providing a Berkeley database back end to give a little higher performance and still disk back and things like that. So if you have an Oracle system, you should be able to plug Bind10 in at some point and have it read your data out of there. Current status, as I mentioned earlier, the prototype authoritative server is done. Since then, we've been making code releases every 4 to 6 weeks. Even though the source code repository is available and you can download the latest snapshot as of this morning, we do also spend a little effort to get an actual release, make a tarball, make sure we have the release notes up to date and things like that. Our next one of those is July 1st, so if you are a little busy right now but want to check it out soon, July is a good time. You can do it on the beach on vacation. Our recursive server deadline is in 9 months, so you should have that then. My last slide here is a call for support. As I mentioned earlier, ISC is a nonprofit open source company, and we Bind10 projects especially need your support. This is all contributions. We'd love to have people come and give us code contributions or point out fixes and things like that. Even just running the code is useful for us. It's a bit early days, but we want your feedback anyway. And then also requirements. If you look at what the software is doing and it doesn't meet your needs, it won't meet your needs in a year either. So we need to know what you need. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to build the software to do that. And finally, for support, we do have a very generous set of sponsors, and it's been fantastic having for me personally to be able to work with this kind of support. But we need more. The recursive server is a much, much bigger project than the authoritative-only server. And as you saw in our project timeline, we still got 3.5 years to go before it's actually done. So please help us out.
All right, thank you very much. Quite interesting. We were speaking about this in 2009. When was it? At one of our meetings. when this was brought up. So we tried to get a little, also to assist a little bit by getting some of the major CCTLDs together with funding. And I'm quite happy that even the small effort that we could make works out. Even we as a small CCTLD, we push a little bit voluntary funding in because we feel that if we use that stuff and it's good, then we should at least try a little bit. It has resulted in that you bought some hardware for our server and things like this. I mentioned this so that all other CCTLDs see that even small contributions can be made and they will come to good use. All right. The final thing,
we have a stand here this week, so if you want to talk at all about Bind10 or anything else that ISC does, please come by and see us. Yeah. Thank you.
We will surely do that. Okay, the next item on the agenda is Roy Ahrens and Simon. Just leave it there. Roy Ahrens and Simon McCullough from Nominet. They will speak about OpenDNSSEC. In connection with Bind, the title is OpenDNSSEC and Bind, so it actually fits quite nicely after this presentation. And you have got, let me see how much time you've got. You've got 25 minutes. There's just one problem with using my computer is I can't do my email now.
Good morning, everybody. My name's Simon McCullough. I'm from Nominet. For those of you who don't know us, we are the UK Domain Registry. We've got about 8.5 million .UK domains. I'm just going to spend the next 15 minutes giving you a quick update on what we're doing with DNSSEC and also talk about a little bit about integration with Bind and the future versions of Bind. So I hope you find this useful. Okay, just really, where are we now? Well, as at the last ICANN meeting in Nairobi, we signed .UK. It was a pretty big deal for us in Nominet. But the reality, and many of my colleagues gently ribbed me on this, is we only really affected 14 top-level domains. So although we made a big song and dance about it, the hard work is still to come for us. The key news for us was there was no real adverse impact on our zone. OpenDNSSEC went in very smoothly, and the signing process happened very straightforwardly. In our own small little way, we had a little ceremony at Nominet, and we signed the zone. So we sympathise greatly with the ICANN IANA folks. For us, it was very much a trial of our technology and our processes, particularly getting those key signing procedures right, making sure we did that really well, making sure we had the right representatives. The key management side of things, very, very important. Also, as I say on the slide, kind of eating our own dog food, really. We, as you know, we've championed OpenDNSSEC. We've been very heavily involved in the development of OpenDNSSEC. So for us, we had to make sure we signed using OpenDNSSEC. It did a very good job, and it worked, and we're very pleased amongst the wider community as well that OpenDNSSEC was working so well. Also, it's about creating a foundation for us. We're now moving on to getting co.uk signed and some of the other second-level zones. So having those basics of process, policy and procedure in place, as well as the technology, was really important. So where next? We're moving very quickly on now to getting co.uk signed. That's a big project for us. It's going to take us for the rest of this year, and we're probably looking at signing in Q1 2011, so somewhere around the same time as .com. We're carrying on contributing to the development of OpenDNSSEC. We think that's absolutely vital that we're still a key player in helping to support that and to make OpenDNSSEC free and available to everybody. We're also we're not doing it alone. We're pushing ahead with a collaboration with both SIDN and NLNet Labs to create a joint testing partnership. We want to make sure that, particularly for dynamic zones, that OpenDNSSEC and Bind play very nicely together and work. So we don't want to try and test that all on our own. We're looking at options, it has to be said. We're not a software company at Nominet, we're a registry. We don't want to end up supporting OpenDNSSEC forever while we've been key contributors to it. We want to look at other options for ongoing support of OpenDNSSEC as it moves towards version 2. So watch this space on that one. A question a few people have asked me is, why haven't we got on and signed co.uk a little earlier? Well, it has 8.5 million domains. That's a pretty big number for me. It's one to lose sleep over getting that wrong. So we've been very, very careful and cautious. It's a dynamic zone. OpenDNSSEC doesn't yet fully support dynamic updates to zones. So that's clearly a challenge we've got to overcome. We also really wanted to let .UK bed in, and we wanted to let the root signing bed in too. As you know, as we said yesterday, our DS records are now in the root. They've been pushed up. We want to let that whole process bed in before we start to sign our second level. For us also, it's not just a technology challenge. It's one of education and awareness amongst our registrar community and our ISPs. We don't really want to be a registry who's got DNSSEC implemented, but no one's using it. We are seeing quite a bit of resistance from the registrar community to take up on DNSSEC, and I understand that entirely. So it's very much about education and awareness for them about why it's important that they also get involved and get their zone signed as well. Just a few challenges really for us. I think for any registry putting DNSSEC in, is we've had to make changes to our operational systems and also our practices and our processes, particularly as we move towards co.uk, you know, making sure we can accept DS records smoothly without any timing issues. That's a very important part of the technology for us. Also, as I said, it's really about creating awareness. My first step is just getting the registrars to care about this. When we've met with them, they've said, well, there's no real business initiative behind this. It's not what we're not what's in it for our registrants. So getting them to care, and then actually getting them to create some kind of action plan to start implementing DNSSEC. The challenge, some people have said, oh, we just need a crisis, but this is not a Y2K problem. There is no looming deadline or for us to have to deal with. So it's very much about a sensible, cautious approach to getting them to start looking at their systems and helping to implement. And clearly, making sure anything we do maintains the stability of the UK registry and the reputation of it too. We don't want to be in a situation where we rush too fast to do something and then cause problems.
Shall I try to take this?
Yeah, go for it.
I'm going to talk to you about three things today. Three of the technical challenges that we had to implement and that we are still implementing at Nominet. The first part is the DNS side of things. As Simon has already explained, we have about 8.5 million names in our register. And that 8.5 million names are divided over very, very large zones. We update these zones every minute. And because of that, we can't have static zones. We need to continuously sign the data. What we can't do is stop everything, take the zone file, mangle it through a zone signer, and then upload it again. There's just no such thing. I've got to get used to this. Okay. So we need to continuously sign the data. And we want to use OpenDNSSEC for this. However, OpenDNSSEC is currently limited to static zones. Dynamic updates and continuous signing in OpenDNSSEC, that's planned for version 2, and version 2 is not here yet. So we need another solution for that. And we've looked around, and actually a few years ago, we started a very nice project with ISC, and this project was called continuous signing. And continuous signing for us basically needed to do three things. Number one is sign the updates when they come in. Number two is keep the NSEC and NSEC 3 records in check. And the last is sign before the signatures expire. The cool thing about OpenDNSSEC is it's written very modular. So what you can do is you can take the signer out and you can place line 7 in. And there are hooks in OpenDNSSEC, and there are basically hooks in bind line 7 to make this work smoothly. So with this, we can have a completely managed key signing approach, right, and fully functional bind 9.7 dynamic updates, continuous signing software. The other part that we needed to deal with is the registry side of things. It's a little bit more straightforward than the DNS side of things. Basically, what you need to do is you need to extend the database. Next to all the normal records that you have, you now need to extend it with the DS record. You also need to extend the Whois interface. What we have chosen is to show through Whois if a zone is signed or not. And the last part that we need to do is we need to allow these DS records come into our registry. We use EPP, and we need to allow registrars to channel these DS records over EPP, so we need to extend the interface for that as well. Last part I'm going to talk about, which is for us very challenging to design and very interesting to do, these are the roles, procedures, and actors. For the whole key management approach, we have four different roles. We have a safekeeper, literally someone who takes care of the safe, who has the access credentials to the safe. And the safe, I'm really talking about this old-fashioned block of metal, right, where we literally store the keys in. Then we have a security officer. The security officer holds the credentials to manage the HSM. We have an administrator. This is a system administrative role, basically manages the non-crypto part of the system, and we have an auditor. And the auditor audits the procedures. Now, a little bit about the procedures. all the actions, this is basically, it's just like a play, if you know what I mean. You have roles, you have procedures, you have roles, basically you have scripts, and these are basically all the actions that one can perform on a signing system. One of these actions can be an acceptance test, export of keys, key rollover, changing of credentials, etc., etc. And what we decided is to tie these roles strictly to the level of responsibility. So in this sense, above my paycheck gets a whole different meaning. Right? We, for instance, the safekeeper, that's typically a role of the CEO. Now, the CEO is not always there in case of emergency. Right? When there is an emergency, we can't immediately reach the CEO, for instance, when she's here in Brussels. So that kind of thing can be delegated to, for instance, the CTO, Simon in this case. Then the security officer and the auditor is basically on the same level. These are the team leaders of the teams that we have. And literally, the administrators are our system administrative team. Now, our project approach, and I'm going to do this really short because we're short on time, we have an agile kindish approach. We have close cooperation between individuals instead of sturdy deadlines. We really have frequent updates between self-organizing teams. Basically, we have a project that needs continuous attention. It's a very complex project to deal with, both on the registry side of things, both on the DNS side of things. The cool thing about this, though, we can do this dualistically in parallel. We can do the signing system at the same time as we can do the registry changes, because these systems in general are independent of each other. Of course, we're not doing this alone. We have some key partners in this. We're working together with Kirai. Kirai is a Swedish company that has done our system design. It's the same company that has done the root signing system design. We are working together with SIDN. SIDN helps us out with testing this whole system. Basically, SIDN is a similar registry as Nominet. They're very large zones as well. In the future, they might want to go to dynamic updates, and they are keen on using OpenDNSSEC in the future as well. We use Synodin for part of the development process, and ISC is our key partner in this for Bind9 support. So a few more things. We are looking for folks who have done testing with Bind9 7. Bind9 7 is currently in Bind9 7.2. The latest full version is 9.7.1, if I'm not mistaken. I'm looking at the ISC guys over there. Yeah, the latest full version is 9.7.1. It does continuous signing. It has support for HSM. Those are the hardware security modules. And we're really looking for other folks who have played with it. Of course, that said, Bind9 7, that's actually a technology that's 10 years old. Bind9 is 10 years old. And we're also looking at Bind10 when we're thinking about signing Codex UK, when we're thinking about this process. So what this also is, just like Shane and what Shane said before, we really need support for Bind10 in this. We have some milestones for OpenDNSSEC. We have version 1.1 released recently, and OpenDNSSEC is now used by ICANN, by Sweden, by the UK, and Denmark is going to use it soon. When I mean ICANN in this sense, they're not using it to sign the root. They're using it to sign all the non-infrastructural zones. Well, that's it for me. And if you have any questions for me or Simon, or if you want to discuss this project, find us in the hallway, find us tonight. We're here.
Okay, thank you very much. I hate really to push presenters to shorten their presentations, which is very rude, but we have a deadline in that sense that I want everybody who wants to go at 11 to watch the Mad Men perform, that we can do that. Are there any questions? Please, if there is questions, use the microphone. We have got two microphones in the audience in case the microphones don't work. One thing about OpenDNSSEC, so maybe I can abuse the prerogative of the chair.
Go ahead.
.NA is going to use it soon, but sooner or later I have to understand how it works. And distance is a problem. I think maybe I must go and travel at some stage, and somebody must run me through it once or twice. with such a small zone that we have and no banks really yet interested, soft HSM is a good option. Once it becomes serious, one can switch then to a hardware a module. Okay, any questions? Oh, we have dazzled the audience. All right. Any questions to the other, to the previous two presentations, or suggestions, or remarks, or whatever?
Yeah. Can I have a question for Andre, perhaps?
Raise your hand, please. Let us see who you speak. Yes, please.
Hi, Will Tan from Cloud Registry.
Yes, sure.
Thanks, Andre, for a very, very informative, very good analysis of security threats for a registry system. I think I'd like to echo your, concerns for registrar security in terms of, I think a lot of registrars are basically people who develop websites, that actually deals with transactions and, important data. They know about SQL injection. They know a little bit less about cross-site scripting, even less about, cross-site request forgery and clickjacking and stuff like that. So yeah, I think the order is actually good. It's good that you're bringing it up, and I think we should really raise awareness in the community about how important it is, to your customers, that you actually protect their data. Second point I'd like to make is that I think with your case study about XSS vulnerabilities in registry and registrar, when you talk about how the Whois data or certain fields are actually not checked for bad data in them, like the address fields, for example, I don't know if it's actually the registry's responsibility, because it's really hard for you to... it's actually the registrar or whoever building the web interface to your, say, Whois data that actually has the responsibility of maybe escaping the data, because anytime you need to develop for the web environment, you actually need to be aware of that. So that's just my comment. Yeah.
Yes, thanks for the remarks. Of course, I agree fully with you in the first case. In the second, in the ideal world, yes, we should trust. We should have registrars who are sanitizing the inputs and outputs, actually.
Right.
But... Oh, okay, it works. But actually, it looks like, from my experience, that registry has to treat the whole environment as the hostile. And try to escape everything possible, just to, sanitize every input, including not only B2C input, which is normally the biggest threat, but also the B2B input. And my point was that registry has to think about this B2B as well as B2C. Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay. We have some diffusion going on. That's not a problem for the people who wish to...
Security alert.
Now, that can be Rod is calling us, or it can be a bomb alarm. I don't know which one is worse. In any case, I think we can break now, and then we'll carry on at 12:30.